Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's good?
I was gonna say chicken butt, but that's not.
It's what's up?
Chicken no, that's butt. It's guess what chicken butt?
Oh, guess what chicken butt? I don't know. I'm terrible with these things.
Yeah. Well, here we are. Yep. Another week.
Another day. Another dollar.
Another dollar.
Today, what are we talking about today?
Today, well, we both read. I'm sure, probably a lot of you. Read Rocks. I just said a lot of you. And I laughed to myself. Like, who the fuck is listening? I'm sure a lot of you read Roxane Gay's really wonderful essay on the price of Black ambition this week. And I know it really struck both of us. And, every week we try to come up with a different topic. And sometimes we have to choose, like, make a composite topic out of, like, different elements. But this was enough.
Yeah. I mean, I actually, sadly, I was not, I haven't been very well versed in Roxane Gay's actual body of work. Like, I had heard of her. Mm-hmm. I don't know where I got the notion that I didn't like her.
I remember you told me that the other day. You made it sound like she had lied on you.
Like she did something real bad.
Then you're like, oh, Roxane Gay. Yeah. You said it like she owed you $50 4 years ago.
Yeah, it was sad. I don't know where the hell I got that from. Reading this and going back and like actually trying to read some stuff after I read how amazing this article was, I was like, oh man, I fuck with her. She could pee.
Yeah, you know, we all sometimes have to, you know, we fall from grace every
we
day.
Have slip ups, you know, mm-hmm. We fall down.
But we get up.
There you go.
I almost sang that.
Same. But yeah, no, so her article, The Price of Black Ambition, is really great. It's a really short read. Well, not really short read, but it's a pretty short read.
It's a fairly short read. It takes so many different turns. There's so much texture to it.
Yeah. And I feel like it's really, really relevant, like, right now. Like, a lot of this conversation has been going on for a while. And it's always cool to see people who are known for their thoughts on other things bring themselves into the equation. Mm-hmm. Which, starting to do, like, a surface dive into her work. That seems to be something she often does, which is really cool. And I found the way she did it to not be, like, aggressive or like oppressive.
She like has this really it's weird because it's not, I don't want to say like authoritative, but like I can consider her, I can think of her as an authority. Like I trust her opinion, I trust her scholarship, I trust the thought and the effort that goes behind her work. But she also has this incredible vulnerability that she brings whenever she writes about herself that doesn't take over the topic in a way that's like egomaniacal.
Yeah, that's a good segue into the text. Like, one of the things that I thought struck out me first, and we're just going to honestly just dive through this article, like, all the way through, mm-hmm. kind of pick it apart a bit, was kind of her first little anecdote. Like, so she was talking about how in kindergarten, mm-hmm. they asked her to do this, like, worksheet where you had to color in some fractions.
A glass is, like, half empty or half full or whatever.
And she got it wrong, ended up getting an F. I mean, I didn't realize you could get an F in kindergarten.
I didn't know you could either.
But eventually her parents found out about it and they made her feel like pretty bad about it. Mm-hmm. And she said that really caused an amazing amount of drive and ambition in her because she didn't want to feel that, I guess, she didn't use the word shame, but that's what I identified it
Absolutely.
As. She didn't want to feel that again. So she really like strived to always be the best student that she can be. I don't know about you, but that like connected with me straight up. I'm pretty well known as like a slacker. Well, not now. I mean, now I'm killing the game.
I was wanting to say I feel like at least every other day you're jumping up my ass about something.
True.
On some real type A shit.
Yeah, but like that's
not
now.
Slacker at all. True. Now, and that is recent. I'll be honest with you.
It's very recent. Yeah. So okay. Anyway, but back in the day, I was a pretty big slacker. But before that, I was actually really, really intense. like straight A student, all like perfect A's, or and that came as a result of a situation happening actually with my dad. And this is, I mean, this is interesting. You're probably not gonna be happy that I'm sharing this, but my sister, she was maybe in the sixth or seventh grade. I'm like really young, super super young.
Yeah, like kindergarten.
She got her first C, and he lit into her, not in like, you know, like beating her ass, but like in terms of like, I'm just
kinder,
saying, you gotta specify
language, but okay, I understand what you're saying.
But he went off, and he was just basically like, I'm nervous for the spiral of what's going to happen. I just don't want you to end up working at McDonald's.
Oh, my parents know. It was always prison. It was seriously like, we had these in elementary school enrichment yeah. classes. And so they're like our first taste of electives in the third grade. It was before, you know, you had something like art class when you were in middle school or high school where you had, you know, an elective. So I think I had one, I think I had mistakenly chosen calculator fun. And
that sounds awesome. That
sounds like something that, actually back then I was really good at it. Now not so much. But you didn't even get letter grades or number grades, which is what we got when I was in elementary school. You just, rather you didn't get them in your, like, elective courses. In your elective course, you just got graded on, like, seldom, like, occasionally, frequently, and consistently. Mm-hmm. So you had, you know, if you're getting, like, basically a straight A or something like that for an elective course, you're getting all consistently. So that means you're just on your shit in calculator fun all the time. And calculator fun was the only elective course where I got one, like, check mark in the frequently box. Mm. So that's just, like, one less than consistently. And I was 8 years old, and my parents told me that if I did this poorly in school again, then I was going to end up in jail. And I was like, wait, y'all, how? Like, how are we going to do that? And they were like, well, if you don't do good in school, you can't go to college. If you don't go to college, you can't get a job. If you can't get a job, you don't have any money. If you don't have any money, you have to sell drugs or steal. And I'm like, what the fuck is drugs?
I mean,
drugs?
When you put it like that, though, like...
So they said that, and I was like, ooh, this is real shit. Like, I cried because I didn't get a 100% on a spelling test. I got a 95% in the third grade. I cried. And my teacher was so freaked out by this. I don't even know if I told my parents this. My teacher was just like,
it's not that bad.
She was just like, this doesn't mean anything. I've never had teachers say that to me my entire life, but she was just like, you know, this doesn't mean anything. And I'm like sitting there sobbing. No, so that shit is real.
Yeah. After that, I was like, well, fuck, I never want to have this conversation with my dad. And it eventually happened because, like, I mean, I got to high school, discovered that, well, I don't even know if it was that. I basically was just like, me being a nerd is not working for my love life. Like, it's just not. Oh, it's just not working. So I switched hardcore over to class clown. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I brought home my first, like, I think I got a D. And my dad, like, lost it. He cried. I was like, whoa, like, this is really intense. So anyway, I got my shit together until I got to Howard. But all that, I feel like, is a similar story. Like, it happens in, like, different cases. And, like, I think the, you know, some environments get it more than others, but...
What do you mean when you say some environments? Oh, some people's homes.
Some people's homes get it more than others, yeah. But I feel like there's this constant, and I don't think that this is exclusive to the Black community.
No.
But this theory of you got to be shamed in order to want to aspire for something great. Mm-hmm. I thought that she took a big step in connecting that to a personal story like that. Mm-hmm. But that really, really hit really close to home. I mean, coming back to the article, I think she talks about how, you know, that sticks with her. That kind of evolves into this perspective that people have on the talented tent.
Oh, yes. Which I think I actually said last week.
Yeah.
That I hate it. I hate the talented tent.
I actually, like, I identify with it. I mean, I was a big W.E.B. Du Bois fan. Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that's a great way to be. I think that's great.
Yeah, but, I mean, she kind of came for him in this article a little bit. Like, I mean, not even a little bit.
But she's not the first person to do that. And I don't necessarily think of it as coming for him when there's, like, a gap of 100 years. You know what I'm saying? In yeah. between. It, like, I think it's just,
I mean, you're
kinda,
not going to be mad.
And his theory is not. It's like people who thought the world was flat. Like, yeah. That's not. Like, given the information that you had at the time, that's not necessarily a wild assertion. So, like, it wasn't a wild assertion back then that 10% of Black folks, the top 10% of us, were going to, like, pull ourselves up our bootstraps and then lasso everybody else and then, like, climb up this mountain.
But the interesting thing about that, the connection she made that to, I guess, white supremacists back in the day, who basically created that, you mm-hmm. know, they didn't make that talented 10th name and give it that kind of brand. But she talked about how basically they said that it would be the 10% of black folk mm-hmm. that would be acceptable or civilized.
Exactly. They're kind of like, all right, we can only take this so much.
Yeah.
We can only take this so many. It reminds me of, I can't remember their names. But I don't remember if it was the Puritans or who, one of the early like Christian groups that came over in like the early United States.
Yeah.
And they were kind of like, look, Jesus told me he can only take but some of y'all back. I think they were like, it's only 144,000 of us that can come and get saved. So it's already been predetermined. So good luck. Like, yeah. That's how I felt like it was the same sort of thing where they're like, it's only 10% of you guys. So other 90%, good luck, y'all.
Yeah. But I mean, I had never heard that connection before though. Like, I mean, that was something it's interesting, especially considering that we are both two HU graduates.
Yes.
And I mean, that's like, that shit's written in like invisible ink on the back of your diploma.
Oh yes.
And you know, it's something
if you put
like,
it under a heat lamp, it turns brown.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the thing about it is like, it's crazy because I'm pretty sure I heard that at orientation from an official of the school.
Heard what?
The concept of talented tent. Absolutely. And us telling
there was a school organization called the Talented yeah. Tent. There were some kids, I don't know who they were. I don't know. I didn't join shit when I was at Howard.
Same.
Most people don't even know that I went there, except for like you.
Yeah.
And like maybe two of our other friends. But I do remember there being a talented tech group. I remember that much. And I remember thinking it was bizarre as fuck. But
it's exclusionary in the sense of it makes people who haven't hit certain like quote unquote touch points.
Mm-hmm.
It makes them feel less than.
Absolutely.
Like they don't have value, which is clearly not the case. It's also why people say we bougie too.
There it excludes a lot of people who may not have certain markers of whatever, yeah. you know, we feel success.
Class success.
Yeah, exact class success is. It also gets some of these highfalutin folks
yeah.
feeling themselves harder than they already have been. It's not always called the talented tenth.
Yeah.
It comes in other shapes and forms. It comes in other ways. It can exist in a variety of different spaces that black yeah. people inhabit. Not necessarily all black spaces. The same dynamic can play out in a workplace, can play out in a different university environment or a different scholastic environment. It makes everybody else feel excluded and feel like shit. It doesn't actually work. You know
yeah.
what I mean? In addition to both of those things, it doesn't actually work. I don't want to use the term respectability politics just because I feel like respectability politics and problematic are everywhere. I feel
yeah.
like some people just learn them and they're like, white privilege.
Intersectional,
respectability politics. And I think those are obviously all valid terms.
Yeah.
But I don't want to just like throw it out there like it's like a casual buzzword. It doesn't matter how good you are. And that's one of the things that obviously, you know, we know it from living life. Roxane Gay discussed it in the essay. It's not just exclusionary. It doesn't just make certain people feel undue pride and just general assholishness, I suppose. But it also doesn't save us from anything. It
yeah.
doesn't get us anywhere, and it doesn't.
You mean we ain't made it yet?
Exactly. Not only have we not made it, I mean, we can't be protected in
yeah.
any way. I can't even wrap. I don't have the speech right now to discuss that. You can only make but so many gains, and we cannot be protected. The fuck?
Oh, yeah, basically.
Fuck? You know?
No, I mean, that's real. And then she also talked about, you know, the statement, you got to be twice as good to be, you know, to get half as much. Those kind of things come, like, hand in hand. Twice as good and talented tent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think those things work together, like peas in a pot.
They absolutely do.
In addition, also playing off of that, like, shame aspect of it. So you can't really be yourself because you have to be twice as good as these white folks in
yes.
order to actually get anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really interesting because, especially considering how much Howard tried to push you into that lane,
mm-hmm.
that Howard was the first place yeah. where I actually felt comfortable
exactly.
saying, fuck all that.
No, exactly. I one of the things that jumped out to me, and I think about Howard in many ways was exactly what I needed at that point in time. I was 17 when I first started school. I had grown up, as I mentioned a million times, in Farmington Hills, Michigan, which is now the demographics are changing. When I was growing up there, it was mostly white people. Like, there were so few black families that everybody in town knew who my parents. This is a town. This is a large suburb. It's 80,000 people.
Wow.
And like, most people in town knew who my sisters and my parents and I were. Like, I got pulled over. I was home 6 months ago, and I got... No, I wasn't. I was home last Christmas, and I got pulled over by a cop, and he was just, I got stressed, yeah. obviously. And he was just, he took my license and he's talking, he's like, oh, your taillight was out. Just wanted to make sure that you knew that. And he, you know, he's like, oh, let me see your license again. So obviously I give him my license.
Yeah.
He starts in a swimsuit. He's like, you were in ballet with my daughter, Stephanie, 10 years ago. How are your parents? How are your sisters? I know that that's totally not.
Yeah. It's never been in an interaction that I've had with the police.
So I, growing up like in just strange suburban environment, it was obviously all I knew, but I was nervous moving to DC. I was nervous moving to an urban area, and I was nervous moving, going to an all-black college because I didn't grow up around any black people. In fact, a lot of black people that I went to high school with didn't fuck with me because I was corny as fuck.
Yeah.
And I wasn't in a lot of their classes. So I was nervous to go to Howard, but something inside me was like compelling me to go. I didn't know it when I decided to go because it was the only place I applied out of state. Attending Howard was like the first time that I had the luxury of forgetting that I was a black person ever in my entire life. And I didn't know that I had been missing that until I went to school there. And it felt like being on vacation for 4 years. Like you said, yeah, it was like the first time that I felt like I didn't have to be representative of anybody. I was a person from Michigan. I was a person who had a Midwestern accent. I was a person who had parents or high school sweethearts or two sisters or like to wear Juicy Couture sweatsuits. I was not, you know, I was a girl.
Yeah.
I was just, I wasn't a black person and then everything else first.
No, I mean, my situation was different, but very similar in that, like, I grew up in a neighborhood around, I grew up around a lot of black people. I'm not going to act like that wasn't the case. I often didn't go to school with that many black people, though. Like, my classes, I was always in, we had honors and standard. I'm not gonna go into that. But I was always in the honors classes, and, you know, usually the only, like, one of, like, maybe three black boys.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were a lot more black girls, but 90% white. 90% white.
Okay.
And that's, like, from elementary to, like, so when I graduated.
It was a similar environment.
Yeah, but we had a lot of black students in, like, in the school.
Oh, we didn't.
That was a different... So, like, I had a lot of black friends, but they weren't in the classroom with me. And also, our interests just, after a certain point, diverged. I mean, of course, I love 3 Six. You know, all the other Memphis staples, I could juke with the best of them. You know,
I've never seen you do that. Okay.
I don't need to. Exactly. Yeah. There was a limit to how I could engage.
Mm.
And so when I got to Howard, at first it was so much pressure because, I mean, I literally had a friend who was in standard classes come to me and be like, Eric, you made it. You got out. You got to go there and do something. And I was like...
That's stress and pressure. Shit was...
Like, I was like, what the fuck, man? Like, come on. I mean, aside from the fact that everybody thought I was going to become, like, a militant, like, black nationalist and grow, like, dreadlocks and try to, like, start a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from that, like, there was all this pressure, like, get there and be, you know, that twice as good to get half as much. Knowing that that's the deal, but that was just what you had to do.
Mm-hmm.
My first year, like, I didn't really know anybody. I had, like, 3 friends at Howard. I didn't really go out there or really talk to people as much.
I didn't know that.
I had a 3.8 GPA.
Maintain that.
That was after my first semester. So I get like 3/4 of the way into my freshman year. I started actually communicating with people. I started actually talking to people. Like starting to lose, not focus, but starting to lose the grasp of that look to your left, look to your right. Somebody's going to be gone and thinking that person is going to be me.
Mm-hmm.
And then starting to think about like who I wanted to be. Obviously, I'm completely fucking different than that person in school.
It's been 10 years.
But, like, it was amazing that I was like, I like to learn. I don't really like to do work. So I'm going to try to do as much of the learning while as little of the work as possible.
Delicate balance. It's like being on a BOSU ball. I know what that's like.
I mean, I got out.
But no, my team.
Yeah, exactly. Like that was amazing for me to like you said, to be able to let go and just be like a person, be a human, just be a man and connect with those people. That's completely gone now.
Well, that's one of the things that I find funny about. And actually, I'm assuming that most HBCU graduates feel this way. And actually, it popped into my head when you were talking about where the theory of the talented Teth came from. It was actually from, I don't know, remember his first name, Henry Morehouse, the guy who started Morehouse, I think it was Atlanta Baptist College or something like that, whatever they called Morehouse was called. before they named it after him. Like, this guy who invented this talented tent, this at the time wealthy white liberal, was like the person Morehouse was named for, which is, it's bizarre.
It's levels
to
this shit.
Yeah, it's levels. I was going to say, it's bizarre. There's levels to it, but it's not any wilder than any
Oliver Otis Howard.
Like, yeah, exactly. It's not any wilder than any of the other shit popping off. Howard was a place where I, like, now I'm an adult, and I was very invested in forming and understanding my racial identity. As, or rather, like, I knew I was black. That was never an issue, understanding that, wrapping my head around that. But what it meant, it needing to mean something at all, was something that I thought critically about for the entire time that I was there, from 17 to, like, 21. But now as an adult that, like, I'm comfortable with my racial identity, and I obviously identify as a black person, and it means something to me, but it's not everything. It's a part of my identity. It's an important part. So it's like a part that can be difficult at times, but now I don't always need to be in that space. I don't always need to be in that space. Howard helped me establish both home, a sense of home, and also like a homeostasis for my life, to the point where it corrected a lot of things. Like, a lot of, this is going to sound so Howard-y, I don't care. It imbued me with a deep love of self and love of people. Okay, all right.
Sorry, see, and that's not funny. That's really not funny.
I know
that's
corny as hell what I'm saying. It's like, true. I feel like Lawrence Fishburne is gonna pop out from around the corner any second.
I was gonna say Alanya.
Early, yeah, exactly. Like, early 90s Lawrence Fishburne is just gonna pop out. Like, I'm Trey Stiles. But it imbued me with a deep sense of, you know, self love and a deep love of people. But it allowed me to be able to figure out what that home base was, so that I could find and establish that everywhere. So it's not like my entire life needs to be like Howard now. I can find home other places, but I also have these safe pockets. Because when I think of Howard, I think of safe. I have these safe pockets. Not all my friend group is all black people, but a lot of them are from school, and a lot of them are from, you know, just living life and being an adult. You know, where I live is important to me. Living in Bed-Stuy, like we talked about last week, I feel, that's what I mean when I say I feel safe here. Because of Howard, I can establish those little pockets of comfort in the rest of my life.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Save big money on everything for your next project. Now at Menards. Spring is here, meaning time for outdoor projects. Cabot Australian Timber Oil is perfect for decks, siding, and outdoor furniture, while providing maximum penetration, durability, and water repellency. Save big money on Cabot exterior stains to get your staining project started today. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Cheers to a great day and this ice-cold Corona.
You know what would make this day even better? My grandma's carne asada.
Throw in some music.
We can watch the game. Or we could keep it simple.
Corona, la vida más fina. Get your Corona at ordercorona.com. Relax responsibly. Corona Extra Beer, imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
I definitely agree with that, but it's also, for me, it's a little different. I feel myself playing into that twice as good.
Oh.
much more now than I ever gave a shit about it for the past 8 years. Mm-hmm. And not because, like, honestly, it's not even just because I'm trying to get half as much shit as white people. That honestly has nothing to do with it. More so just feel an immense amount of pressure about the decisions I make and what that will mean for my family. That I really never thought about before. Like, I thought about it, you know, if you're always thinking about it, you're like, I want to provide this, I want to, you know, have this like Cosby-esque lifestyle. Mm-hmm. But then once you get out, you get a job, your first job, and you're like, oh, I don't get paid anything. How the hell am I actually supposed to make enough to justify
myself? Oh, I understand exactly what you're saying. At first, I misunderstood you. I thought you meant that now having a family, like, had occurred to you. It's more, will I be able, not just, like, will I experience this shame, or will I disappoint my parents, or will I disappoint myself, but often unevenly stacked debt.
Yeah.
So I sound corny as hell. How am I able to make a house of cards? me and my family living.
Exactly.
But it's the truth.
No, and it's sad because in me having those fears or whatever, I'm playing into that system that I don't fucking agree with, Lord knows. But what's the alternative? Like, there's, I don't know the alternative.
Yeah, truly don't.
You know, that's not even really a real question. I don't know. That's just an interesting thing that's kind of resulted from that. And it's, you know, it's something I think we can come back to, but I just always feel the need to be trying to do more. I mean, this is probably why I'm up everybody's ass all the time.
You are.
But that's where it stems from.
One just tiny little point, just to piggyback off what you brought up, family, because I hadn't actually necessarily thought of that when I was processing, you know, this piece. But what I don't want, anybody who knows me or has met me before knows that I have like a thick layer of I don't give a fuck, just slathered upon my person. But I still, at the core of me, have that very intense, you know, same thing. Like, gotta be up an hour earlier. I need to be 5 steps ahead. I need to be 8 times as prepared. I still have that at my core. In addition to so many other things, it made me so stressed as a young person. It made me such a stressed out kid. I don't want to pass that stress along to my children. And so when I think about, I know you said it's not a real question, but when I think about how do we not have that, I mean, I don't want my children to see me. I mean, I want them to see the reality of things. I don't want to sugarcoat anything. I guess like the browbeating and the almost like just like emotional self-flagellation that can come with feeling like you're a failure. You haven't done everything or your ambition has not been satiated. I don't want my children to see me working through the extra shit of that. I want them to be able to feel like they can be people.
I completely agree with that. But I think the thing that I've struggled with that reality could look like for me is that I also don't know how to connect that with seeing what my kids will be like and probably being like, oh my God, you guys got to get your shit together. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's going to look completely different. I know I'm not going to be able to process that at all. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm going to struggle with it. And I mean, this is jumping ahead a little bit, but it reminds me very much of Black-ish.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Sad. Oh my God. I never thought I would say I identify with a character played by Anthony Anderson.
I mean, you heard it here first.
But like, that shit is real. That fee hockey shit?
Yes.
Like, if my child came to me and was like, y'all want to play fee hockey, I would literally roll up and die.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I talked to my parents after the first week of Black-ish came out, and I was just like, I think we talked about this beforehand. Yeah. We discussed Black-ish. You and I knew that we were interested in it. We wanted to watch it. We wanted to support the show. More so, I realized that the show is really, really, really about, it's about a family, but it's really about how Rainbow and Andre, Tracy Ellis Ross and Anthony Anderson's characters, sort of are caught between two worlds. Like, the children kind of are, but they're still sheltered by youth. But how their youth and also their parents, the life that their parents have provided for them, but just how parents deal with that. So I want to know how if my parents identified with it. I talked to my dad was like, oh yeah. there's such a bizarre tension. Well, my parents are, you know, were born and raised in Detroit. My sisters and I primarily grew up in the suburbs of, and my parents had no idea how to parent 3 Black girl children in this primarily white environment. They did the best that they could, but there were so many gaps as far in my like upbringing between, like, my parents, they, like I said, they did the best that they could, but I think it's almost impossible to be able to account for the weirdness of that environment and just how like just utterly it like unprepared as a parent you are.
I think Black-ish and what you just described, like, though, that tension and that stress of trying to like deal with the weirdness of your kids and not necessarily recognizing that is compounded by the fact that they lived in a white neighborhood and they kind of made it, you know, which I think is very similar to what you just described. Mm-hmm. I think that is going to happen at any level, especially with how, and this is going to make me sound real fucking old, but like with how weird kids are today.
No.
Like, I think, like, it also made me think about
Jaden Smith.
Like, oh my God, this.
This child.
Hoodie dress.
Yo, hey.
The hoodie dress. No. I'm not knocking it. After watching the Fast music video 3 times.
Oh, yeah.
Hit
some squats. Get that hoodie dress,
you know,
on.
I got to get my thigh game right. Out. But, you know, maybe. What the hell? Why not? Summer. I was trying to be cool.
We can match.
Maybe on my bike.
Please wear the hoodie dress on your bicycle.
People make so much fun of Jaden Smith. But, like, at the end of the day, he is himself. And he is really changing And oh my God, it's gonna sound ridiculous, but he is changing how you can be successful and weird, and also be pretty black. Yeah. I mean, he's black.
No,
he
got locks. Even Willow too.
Like, Willow too, definitely with my hair, almost to a higher degree if you think about
yes.
it.
And you know, I follow her on Twitter.
So you say you follow a how old is she? A 14-year-old?
Yeah, she's real cool. I look up to her. Oh, okay. So I look up to her. I look up to her because she's actually 13. But she is extremely self-possessed in a way that I actually, like, in all truth be told, she is extremely self-possessed in a way that I am still trying to access at 26. And I you know what? May God himself strike me down for saying that, because that is a damn truth.
I feel like the both of them are. But basically, yeah, what we're saying is, like, it's going to be a challenge. But I'm also, that also makes me really happy that there is some, like, possible way that I don't understand right now.
Mm-hmm. Money plays into
money
it.
Definitely will help.
Fame also helps. Yeah. Yes.
There's this possibility that there's this role that they can have where they can be as, you know, weird as they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
Wear all the hoodie dresses in the world.
Yeah, I think they actually, honestly, I saw a picture of Willow in a fader.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the same hoodie dress. They share. Which is cute. That's so cute. Keep going.
Hand-me-downs. You know, that they'll have this path forward to something where they'll feel more comfortable in their own skin. And maybe they can access their relaxed feeling of being able to just kind of let go.
Being.
And as Jaden says, pre-exist.
That's what he said. At the beginning of the
night. Well, no. He says, like, in. And I just pre-exist. Yeah.
I was singing a song to myself at work today. And I like, had to pause. And I was just like, okay, we're doing this now.
No, so there's definitely that. And the thing, I guess, to tackle the flip side, and this was one of the few points of contention I had with the entire article, mm-hmm. to bring it back to the text.
Bring it back. I wanted to see Travis Porter. I'm sorry.
Yeah, a little different.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Obama announced the program My Brother's Keeper.
Mm-hmm.
So My Brother's Keeper is looking to not necessarily reform, but increase the opportunities that young men of color have in the world.
Hold on, let me just read exactly as quoted in the article. An interagency effort to improve measurably the expected educational and life outcome. Educational and life equated is very interesting right there. Educational and life outcomes for and address the persistent opportunity gaps faced by boys and young men of color.
So she had some serious issues with this, because she said, on the surface, so I'll give her that it seems like she hadn't necessarily done a deep dive into the merits of the program,
mm-hmm.
but she took issue with the way that the program was developed. It seemed to be playing into this respectability politics game, in that they try to get young men of color to dress better, to quote unquote take more responsibility within mm-hmm. the community, and you know, the kind of pull up your pants aspect that everybody came at Bill Cosby for, in addition to like Don Lemon and all them.
Mm-hmm.
That I agree with, but I don't think that's necessarily what the program is. Just from my job history, mm-hmm. I've actually done some work with programs like My Brother's Keeper. There's a program in New York run by the city called Young Men's Initiative. And there are a variety of different programs that My Brother's Keeper actually worked with to develop their programming.
Mm-hmm.
And a part of that is used. Like, they do, you know, they encourage the young men to like wear suits, to dress, mm-hmm. to dress quote unquote appropriately, to talk appropriately with a more mm-hmm. conservative fashion. A part of that does kind of rub me the wrong way. But what I will say is, doing that provides these young men access to opportunities that they would not
be able to have.
Otherwise.
I'm saying, quote unquote, grooming.
Yeah. So, like, it's all well and good to say that we should be accepting these young men as they are,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, still working to provide better educational opportunities, mm-hmm. and opportunities, period. But at the end of the day, nobody's coming to meet a little black boy where he is.
And I didn't so much get from reading the piece that she was attacking My Brother's Keeper. I think you're both in the same space, actually, where I also am, where long term, nobody's currently coming to meet a little black boy where he is. Long term, that's my goal.
Yeah.
I think that is fair. I think that, you know, I think that a lot of non-black and brown children, so children, yeah, a lot of non-black and brown children are have the leeway to kind of be met where they are.
Yeah.
You know, black and brown boys, a lot of the time, since we're speaking about them specifically, they're rarely, if ever, met where they are. And I think that they deserve that consideration. They deserve that personhood. They deserve that humanity. So long term, I would, and I'm sure you would as well, like to live. I prefer to live in a society where my brother's keeper isn't necessary. But short term, that's something I can get. Short term, I can get behind it.
Yeah.
You know, short term, I can get behind it. I can get behind it while still feeling critical of some of the tactics. Even feeling on some level ashamed. I almost hate that, like, I feel ashamed of the tactics because I didn't set the tempo at which the tactics were necessary.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. At the end of the day, I think you look at, like, you look at the data and mm-hmm. you talk to the kids and the shit is bleak. Like, so you got, it kind of needs to be where it is. But I agree. I mean, I think you can be critical. And I'm there are definitely parts of these types of programs I don't necessarily agree with. And it's even been, you know, it's even being explored whether or not they're like, their actual utility. But in terms of, like, the results that they create.
This shit is Band-Aids. Like, I used to work for a city councilwoman. She was a social worker. And she actually worked for a different city councilwoman who's now since passed away, but she was serving until she was like in her 80s. I think her 80s. But she used to say that social work, or, you know, and kind of social programs and initiatives were really just a Band-Aid for, you know, shitty policy.
Yeah.
So ideally there can be more than one. Like, I see what you're saying. There was actually another just tiny little point that this brought to mind. I've been interested in the research behind grit. Mm-hmm. Which has been studied by Angela Lee Duckworth, I think, of University of Pennsylvania. She got a MacArthur Genius Grant. She's done a TED Talk on it. It's wonderful. Basically, grit is kind of this, now it's become somewhat measurable. It's this educational term or concept or skill, I think it's a skill, that is not quite the same as intelligence, but people are looking to measure it in the same way, or to teach aptitude, like the same way that people teach intellectual aptitude, mm-hmm. the same way they try to, I guess, shape that. They are trying to, like, shape grit in a similar fashion. And grit is literally whether or not you can keep going in the face of setbacks to achieve long-term goals. So I had read about it before. I had, you know, seen, like, Duckworth talk. They had a piece on Vox earlier this week talking about how grit as a concept in some education circles had gained popularity specifically because it was equally attractive to do more research on grit with poor students as it was with ones who were more well off. You know, right now they don't know how to teach it, quote unquote. They don't know how to measure it, or, you know, a lot of colleges or college admissions programs are like, oh, you know, if we could figure out a way to test for grit, then we would use that instead of, you know, IQ tests or instead of college board tests. Like, if we could figure out, like, basically people want to bottle grit and figure it out. It drives me crazy because in the article they sort of, like, make it sound like the concerns of wealthy children who are kind of lazy, like, teaching them grit is just as important as teaching poor students who don't have shit grit, which terrified me because I'm just like, it makes me so angry. And I don't think that grit in and of itself, the concept, is bad. I think it's worth exploring. I find it really fascinating. But what scares me is that it's going to be the newest tool. It could be touted as the newest tool, which is not to say anything of, you know, Lee Duckworth mm-hmm. or other people who are in education circles or who are researchers and who know much more about this than I do. I'm nervous that grit can be touted as this new salve that's just gonna, oh, so, okay, even though we don't have to, like, you know, we have these structural inequalities and these kids are lacking resources, if we just teach them grit, which is funny to me that grit is touted as this new concept, because grit is essentially, that's like the lodestone of Black ambition. That is, like, the cornerstone of Black ambition.
So, like, I'm mad we got to this point. Like, it's probably like 53 minutes in, because this actually just really, really made me think of something else that really relates to that. So mm-hmm. there are actually a couple of articles. I was trying to find one of the other ones right now that deal with this exact same topic. So one of them, and I think we actually talked about this a long time ago. Unfortunately, obviously not, like, recorded.
No.
But so there was an article that talks about why some minorities are more successful than others.
Oh my gosh, this was from January,
way back.
New York Times.
Yeah, exactly. And so this New York Times article basically tried to almost develop a formula for it. They called it drive. They didn't call it grit. But they found that specific minority groups, Africans, a lot of Asian groups, in terms of, like, you think about, like, Koreans, Chinese.
Japanese.
Some Japanese.
And I want to say they also said that people who are culturally Jewish also.
Yes. So a lot of that shame aspect comes back into it and plays, like, right into that. Like, that was actually one of their factors in terms for creating and teaching drive.
Right.
And, you know, that was like the unhealthy way of approaching it. Yes. But there was actually this really interesting article in the Times as well by Paul Tuff called Who Gets to Graduate? There's these researchers at the University of Texas, and they were trying to get a better handle on how they could create an environment where minority students stick around longer. And I hate to say tough it out because it makes it seem like they couldn't take it. But you know, minority students were experiencing all of these problems on top of them struggling with the work that was causing them to drop out. Obviously, the graduation rates for minorities are much lower than they are for white students. So they created this program to kind of create this grit, create drive. And it's not approached in the same manner. It's a little more touchy-feely. Which is fine.
I like that.
You know, basically what they found, almost creating like an It Gets Better campaign, changed the game. So what they would do, they would have...
Yo, I'm mad as hell you never sent me this.
I'm
but
sorry.
Go ahead.
I was sending it to you. It's really good.
Right, send to me now. Go ahead.
So they had these students on the first day of their like sophomore year, record these narratives. So they had to write a small essay, and they also had to record like an audio piece where they basically talked about how they like they struggled. And, you know, they went through a lot. They had a lot of, like, setbacks. But they just worked with, you know, their peers and worked with the professors. And it got better. Like, you know, they were able to kind of work through it and really, you know, feel a lot more comfortable in the environment, even though there weren't that many minorities, be able to progress. And the students who participated by watching these narratives or reading these narratives had an amazing surge in terms of performance. And there were other components as well. They had like really intense tutoring. They got a lot of minority professors together and created like support groups for them as well. But the program performed so well, they're actually in the process of exporting it to the larger, to everybody, which goes back to that everybody needs that drive teaching, quote unquote. So I don't know. I thought it was really, really, really interesting, the connections there. We should probably come back and talk about that at another time.
Yeah, we should actually. We definitely should.
You know, it was amazing to really think about all of these factors that go into drive, that go into ambition. But I think the component that comes after that is what happens when you reach a little bit of success. So, you know, one of the things she talked about was that, you know, no matter what she achieves, and she has an amazing amount of achievements.
This was like a
starter course, a 101 course for me. But she talked about how she got her PhD, you know, how she's written, you know, multiple published books.
Oh my gosh, she's a prolific essayist.
Yeah.
Like, she's not just a prolific essayist in these huge publications, but also in different online spaces. She's on Twitter all day long. I know because I follow her. She has an amazing Tumblr. Like, this woman is, she obviously wouldn't say this about herself in the article, but any medium she gets to write, she just lights the shit the fuck up.
Yeah. I mean, she legit. I'm not even gonna lie. Like, I don't know why I had issues.
Everybody gotta learn sometimes.
Exactly. I'm a fan. He did say that.
Yeah.
But no, I am a fan. And I also identified with this idea this feeling that she had of like, regardless of all of these things, she still is not satisfied. And a part of that not being satisfied, I think comes from, and I might be, you know, conflating her words, but I think a part of it comes from just that original experience she had back in kindergarten. Mm-hmm. And a part of that also comes from the kind of needling that she's experienced at like every point in her life.
Absolutely.
At the hands of white and, you know, and other cultures. You know, she talked about people thinking she was an affirmative action student because she was the only black person in a PhD program, and a variety of other things that kind of caused this perception.
That's essentially what that is. That somebody seeing you where you're not supposed to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, calling you out many times publicly, calling you out. It doesn't always have to be, you know, microaggressions. Sometimes people will just flat out call you out in front of everybody. Even I think about when Roxane Gay, they announced that she was the editor of the Toast new vertical, The Butter.
Yeah.
There were people on Twitter all day coming for her credentials.
Like, she ain't worthy.
Right. Like, she ain't fucking worthy. Yeah. Like, all you have to do is look at a New York Times bestseller list. You're going to see a woman's name twice.
Yeah.
Twice in the same year. Twice.
And, I mean, the interesting thing, the thing that I can kind of connect this with, and this is sad to compare the two, but also,
I don't even know what you're going to say, but I can already tell us that it's about to be some shit, but go ahead.
But, like, Black-ish, where Homeboy got the SVP of Urban, like, I'm not going to lie, I would have been mad, too. I wouldn't have did the ignorant shit that he did in terms of, like,
no, the commercial. No, because I still need to go to work. I still need to get
exactly,
paid.
Like, let's be real.
Yeah, if I got four fucking kids... I'd be like, thank you.
Like, you just want to finish straight.
Thank you much.
If I was Rainbow, I would have had a lot more issues with that.
Yeah, you know, I would have popped
off. Because he was wild. But, I mean, it's crazy to think, no matter where you get to, there are always going to be people who are trying to add an asterisk to your name or have these caveats or disclaimers about, like, mm-hmm. who you are and why you have your success. Honestly, though, that still didn't... I mean, it bothers me, but it feels like such a constant.
It's, like, normal.
I was like, but okay.
It's like, yeah. I mean, it's white noise.
That wasn't what struck me about... For me, didn't connect with, like, gatekeepers or people, like, denying my success. Because, you know, I am very confident in...
You are.
And what I have achieved.
You're feeling yourself.
But
24/7.
I do never feel satisfied.
I know that about you also.
It's something that's frustrating. It's also kind of scary because I've seen the same thing in my family in terms of
one could guess.
Yeah.
A few people that come to mind that I know.
But
one could guess.
Like I talked to people and it was really interesting when I went back from my high school reunion because I've hit these quote-unquote markers of, like, what I'm supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
If someone was doing, like, a profile of you and they use the word successful, you're thinking, like, this person is rich. Like, that's my immediate connection to
success. Okay, so you're saying, like, oh, okay, like, you're obviously successful, but you're not fucking...
I'm not, like...
Jay-Z.
Yeah.
You're not fucking...
I'm not killing it out here. But, like, I've done okay. I don't feel that at all. I feel just as, quote-unquote, behind.
Oh, I was going to say behind. I've always felt behind. And even, you know, like I said, when you talked about never feeling satisfied, never feeling successful, I'm comfortable saying that I have not reached, you know, a level of professional success that I feel, I mean, I still feel kind of young. And I'm still kind of like in the early stages, but I know plenty of people who are further along than I am in their careers, in different fields. And I'm talking like people who are getting like degrees at the top graduate schools for their field,
yeah.
or, you know, in Ivy League or having these amazing jobs or like maybe are one of the top, you know, or in that top like 3-5% of the people who do their job in the country. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And whenever I point out, well, these people are, maybe they're related to me, maybe they're friends with me, but I'm always like, well, you did this, and they don't see it. It's like, they're like, yeah, well, I think of one of our very best friends who went to graduate school, like, you know, she graduated, I don't know, maybe a year or two ago. She was always so stressed out in school because there were so many, I didn't realize it, we had been in sort of a Howard bubble and like the post-Howard bubble where you stay in DC. When you go to a different environment where you're no longer like in that like safe place, you don't, when you're in that DC bubble or that HBCU or HBCU light or like diet HBCU, which is kind of actually how we live now if you think about the way our social life sometimes works. When you leave that and you're in a starkly different environment, she just all of a sudden was like met with all of these people who, whether or not they were gatekeeping, they always were going to have more. So even if she went in and she did her best, part of it was going to be dissatisfaction because of the same dissatisfaction that I think we're all, that Roxanne is getting at and that we all kind of experience. But another is like, you're always going to be looking sidelong at the people around you who likely aren't Black and what it is that they can have that you may never have access to. And so like, she didn't say that explicitly and I don't mean to put words in her mouth, but I know that sometimes for me, that can be there.
I actually do think she kind of said that. I mean, the one part that I kind of pulled out, I think relates to that really well, and I'm going to go ahead and read it.
Oh, go for it.
All along, though there were these insistent reminders of how, even with all these advantages, certain infrastructures so profoundly shaped by racial inequality would never willingly accommodate me or my experiences. Like, that's what you were talking about.
I would never be able to work hard enough. I didn't have to be twice as good. I had to be four times as good or even more.
But she said, this is why I'm relentless. This is why I'm not satisfied and likely never will be. That shit is scary to read from someone who has two New York Times bestselling books.
Somebody who I look at every day and like, curious to see just what she's, what is she eating for breakfast? Like, she's, how is she going to word that?
Yeah.
Like, and this is, you know, she still feels the dissatisfaction. I used to always attribute it to, and this is why it was almost scary for her to name it. Because I've seen it in a lot of people I know who are, actually, wait, this is some new shit. I used to think I only saw it in friends of mine or family members of mine who were type A.
Mm-hmm.
But you talked about, we just talked about how you were kind of a slacker. And, like, even for a while, like, I kind of was too. But I got to a certain age, maybe somewhere around 24, 25. Actually, no, in my earlier 20s, I was, like, so fucking serious about being an adult and, like, having my shit together. But I sort of, once I left... like sort of like young adulthood, and I realized that I was running the same race with the rest of the world. I've had like an adult onset type A personality disorder, which is obviously completely made up, but
I know that feeling.
Yes, you know that feeling, and I've seen it in so many other people. It's not the first time that now that she's kind of put this in context and she's kind of named it. It's even if it's not your natural inclination, like I am a type B personality to the fucking core. And I know that in many ways you are too.
Yeah.
But we both hit this point where we were just like, yo. And it's not just like becoming an adult or growing up. It's more like, it's not just getting your shit together, quote unquote. It's also this, I need to get up every day and I need to be trying to fucking get it. Because if I don't, I do not know what will happen to me.
Yeah. Like, I don't know if I'm gonna make it.
Right. Exactly. And that's so bizarre when I hear you say that. I look at you and I know you, I'm your friend, I know your life. When you say, I don't know if I'm gonna make it, that to me, and logically, I'm like, this sounds preposterous. You know what I'm saying? But I know what you feel.
Yeah.
Because I feel that all the time.
I still feel two steps away from poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm much further than that. And like, you know, there's a level of privilege just floating in the ether right now with what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, like, I really feel like with two mistakes, I could be, everything that I've worked for could be done. It's done.
Always. I know that feeling never leaves me.
Overall, I mean, I think to kind of, I mean, I know we have to kind of wrap it up, but this article is just amazing. And I think to end it on a lighter note, I think the price of ambition, that's the title of the article, is really that shame. Now, whether it's caused by your parents or caused by these systemic factors, white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism,
racism,
like
fun stuff.
Yeah, it's there for me. A lot of it still came from my parents, because before I knew white supremacy, racism, patriarchy, and all of those, not buzzwords, but all these real things,
academic
that
terms,
yeah, academic terms,
shit.
I knew what they told me, and they told me that if I wasn't perfect,
if you're not perfect, you don't get to play.
Yeah,
you don't get to participate.
That shit really messed me up. And it reminded me of, so recently, this Adrian Peterson, you know, situation where he mm-hmm. beat his kid. So the NFL commentators were talking about this, and it was interesting because they went off the rails and they were like speaking from the heart. One of them, Chris Carter, was like,
I was going to say, I don't know anything about sports, but I knew that guy's name because I watched the video.
Yeah. And he was like, I'm sorry, my mom beat me, and it was what she knew to do.
Yes, but my mom was wrong.
That connects with me so much. Like, I love my mom to death. It wasn't just my mom. It was my mom and my dad. But I think that's wrong. I don't know what right looks like. Like, I don't know how to give it to my kids better. But I know that it's gotta change.
Absolutely. I told you earlier, I want my children to be, you know, should I have them? Jesus Christ. I want them to be unburdened. I want them to be, think like, oh God, I'm about to quote Kerry Washington.
Quota.
Right. I can't remember the exact words, but I'm about to quote Kerry Washington. And I don't like she's, you know, fucking Infozake Zhange, but she said something about how she doesn't want to live in a world where people don't, her race can't be acknowledged, or, you know, people are colorblind to her race. She also doesn't want to live in a world where she's defined, like her choices and her life's trajectory, I think maybe she said, is defined by it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I want for my children. I still want them to have the same like pride in our shared heritage and in our family's heritage and all the things that her, you know, like foreparents did to be able to, like, all the things my children's foreparents did to make their lives possible and hopefully make their lives very easy. But I don't want them to ever feel limited. And like you said, I don't want them to feel that shame. And I don't want them to see me experiencing that shame. I want them to feel light. I want them to feel free.
And on that note, it's been good.
It's been good.
I need like a warm apple cider.
I know. I need one with like some alcohol in it.
I just need to watch Adventure Time for a little bit. Just come away from this.
I was gonna say, yeah, I might go on ahead and get on Netflix.
Transparent.
Oh yeah, you told me to watch Transparent.
Anyway, thank you guys.
Thank you guys so much. We really appreciate it.
And we'll talk soon.
Yep. Bye.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.